Let us pray. Come, Holy Spirit, and make within us your dwelling place and home. Give us ears to hear good news and mouths to speak good news, and so fill our hearts and our lives that we may be bearers of good news in all we do and say. And we ask this through Jesus Christ, our Lord. Amen. Well, good morning. It's lovely to be with you today, and thank you for the invitation to be back here again. And I'm also looking forward to joining with you for Easter camp this year, even though I have no idea what's going to happen or how it works. I'm sure we'll find out. Today, I'm going to offer you what I call a bunch of flowers sermon, with a few ideas around a similar theme. As with any bunch of flowers, there might be a flower you like more than others, so just take it in that spirit. I was asked to speak about hope today, and based on my own recent experiences and my engagement with this text that we just heard, to me it seems that hope is never glaring. It's never as obvious as we might like. For me, I find hope in the cracks, in the margins, in unexpected places, and sometimes in places of deep despair and darkness, in surprising places. And so I'm offering today this idea of hope in the cracks as the kind of abiding theme for me anyway today. Yesterday, a group of us were involved in the Gaza ceasefire pilgrimage, some of your congregation here and people from all over Perth, more than 200 altogether. And we were number 7 in the world of the Gaza ceasefire pilgrimages. There will be, before Easter, 125 at least in 17 countries, and each one of those pilgrimages will have the same spirit, the same intention. And the intention of the pilgrimages is listed in the 4 demands, which I'll just read to you off the website. There's a website, GazaCeasefirePilgrimage.com, which is for the global movement. What are the pilgrimages calling for? Firstly, enduring and sustained ceasefire in Gaza, the immediate flow of life-saving food, water, aid, fuel, and humanitarian assistance. Thirdly, the release of all hostages, both the Israeli hostages held by Hamas and the Palestinian hostages held in the Israeli prison system. And finally, an end to the occupation so that a just peace can begin. They are audacious demands and not uncontroversial. But this movement, the Gaza ceasefire pilgrimage movement, is being led by Palestinian Christians, and in particular by the Christians of Gaza. And it's not always well known and often overlooked that there are Christians in Gaza. Now, there are about 2,000 of them out of a population of 2 million, so they are a very small minority. But the main centres for Christianity in Gaza are Holy Family Church in Gaza City, which is a Catholic congregation with a primary and high school, St. Porphyrius Church, Greek Orthodox Church, which is the third oldest Christian place of worship in the world, and Al-Akhli Hospital, which is the Anglican Church hospital, which is predominantly a children's hospital, been operating for many years. And all of those sites have sustained bombing. And yesterday we heard a tragic story, and you'll see a photo of her in a moment, of one of our dear sisters here in Perth. Her name is Cammie, and some of her family members were shot by snipers as they were leaving Holy Family Church where they were sheltering, and they went to go home and get food and clothing, and were shot on the way, and then people went out to help them and they were shot as well. It's just a horrifying situation in Gaza. And so yesterday the pilgrimage followed this route. So what we intended to do was to map the distance from Gaza City to Rafah, and to map it on our bodies and to map it on to Perth. So you see that the pilgrimage walked from Hillary's to Bathers Beach in Fremantle, which is about 31 kilometres, and that's the distance that people who fled from Gaza City in the north to Rafah in the south, that's how far they had to walk, which on one level only took us a day, but on another was a very taxing experience. And our people did it well-fed and well-watered, and with me driving the support vehicle, it was probably a lot easier. We were joined by quite a rich diversity of people. There were Muslims and Jews and Christians, all different flavours of Christians from the different expressions of our faith, and people of none of the above, people who came to be supportive. there's a couple of little clips here to get a sense of how things, that's us setting off from Hillary's. It was pouring rain, and it was one of those amazing things where we'd planned for every eventuality except rain. We had ice and water and every conceivable foot treatment device, but yeah, no umbrellas. And so you'll see the group there setting off south from Hillary's. And at each stop, so there were eight stops along the way, at each stop we joined in prayer. And obviously in an interfaith setting, we had to be both welcoming and inclusive and also respectful. There were also stops along the way for our Islamic brothers and sisters to pray at their appropriate times. And at each prayer stop, we, of course, acknowledged the country that we were on and acknowledged that the history of colonization and oppression on this land, and also recognized that for Christians, in terms of our heritage, our hands are not clean when it comes to the situation in the whole of the Middle East and, in fact, in the whole world, our complicity with empire and with the colonial projects. And that we, as Christians, in terms of our heritage, have been extremely guilty of anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, and engagement with, you know, support for colonial enterprise. So we acknowledge that in our prayer at each stop, but most particularly prayed for peace and particularly prayed for a ceasefire in Gaza. Ceasefire is the primary ambition of the Gaza ceasefire pilgrimage. It's in the name. We were glad and proud to walk with explicitly Christian symbols, not because we want to minimise the experience of the many Muslims in Gaza, but because we wanted people not to forget about the Christians in Gaza and to also kind of subvert the assumption, subvert the narrative that this is all about Hamas or this is all a Muslim versus Jew problem or an Arab versus Jew issue. As many of you will know, there are in the West Bank, there are many, many more Christians than there are in Gaza. And in the state of Israel, there are now, in fact, more Christians living in Israel than there are in Palestine. This is partly due to immigration and partly because many Christians have been able to leave the West Bank. But there are people who will say, well, of course, there are no Christians in Gaza, which is just factually incorrect. And there's also a tendency to portray all Palestinians as Muslims without recognizing, of course, that there are Christians throughout the Middle East, Arab Christians, who are our sisters and brothers. So you see us walking with crosses. And once we got down to Fremantle, we stopped first outside St. John's Church in Mollyrop Court, formerly King's Square, and our friends from the Melkite Catholic Church led us in prayer in Fremantle. If you don't know, the Melkites are Eastern Catholics, not to be confused with Roman Catholics. Eastern Catholics and there are lots of Melkite Christians in Palestine, and the bulk of the Palestinian Christian community here in Perth is at the Melkite Catholic Church, which is in Mount Lawley, so just nearby. And I was privileged to go to their mass the other day, and which is in Arabic. But I got the gist. Fortunately, the sermon was in English, so that was helpful. We're obviously welcome to country. Many of you will know the Reverend Mitch Garlett, who welcomed us to country once we got to Bathers Beach. And we also heard from Father Elias, who is the Melkite priest, who spoke in English and Arabic, again calling for peace and ceasefire. And up in the right-hand corner there, that younger gentleman is Jason Damouni. Jason is the chair of Palestinian Community of Western Australia. He's a subdeacon in the Melkite Church. You probably know what a deacon is, but subdeacons are an order, particularly in the Eastern churches, who help the deacons, because everyone needs help, right? So you have subdeacons as well. And Jason was one of the key organisers behind the pilgrimage. Lots of different people walked and showed their solidarity in different ways, and we were very strongly focused on a non-violent witness. It's tempting sometimes to get angry and get shouty and even to get aggressive towards other people because of the pain. And I see that from people from all different faith and cultural traditions who have connections to the crisis that's happening. But for us, the discipline of nonviolence for the movement globally is absolutely critical. So we did things like made sure we walked in double file and didn't take up the whole path because we wanted to let people through, cyclists and people walking their dogs. And we had we trained people as we went, and because people did, they slowed down their cars and shouted obscenities. People stopped and asked what was happening, and some reacted negatively to that. And teaching us to respond not with passivity, but simply to respond with dignity. by saying something like 10,000 children have died and we're bearing witness to that loss, or to say we are seeking peace, primarily peace. Peace is what we care about. And that's a big shift for people, because a lot of us act out of anger. When we have deep feelings, we let them overcome us. I do sometimes. I'm sure you do as well. And so the discipline of a movement like this to live out nonviolence is absolutely critical. And so for me, the signs of hope were the diversity of people that were there, people that I didn't know were coming, people from all different parts of our community. Now, the sign of hope, too, that the Palestinian Christian community were platformed and prioritised. And in the planning, the number of Palestinian Christians who said some version of this, they said, "My parents told me, never tell anyone that you're Palestinian. Never tell anyone that you're Palestinian. Just fit in. Just be normal. Just fit into Australian society. Because if you say you're Palestinian, they will assume that you're anti-Semitic. They'll assume that you're violent. They'll assume that you're Muslim, even if you're not. And it will colour all of your relationships. And you can understand why parents might say that to their children. Just hide it. And let's acknowledge, too, that for many Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, we're told that as well, as that when they were children, don't tell anyone, hide it. And so for a lot of the Palestinian Christians who were involved in the pilgrimage, this was like a coming out experience where they actually said, yeah, I am Palestinian. I'm also a Christian. I'm not anti-Semitic. I'm not a supporter of Hamas. And I am standing up for children, for those who have died, for human rights, and in particular for ceasefire. So there were signs of hope, and I thought it would be perhaps helpful today to go close to Gaza in the scriptural text that we were reading today. I think we do need to be careful when we read the scriptures with that, as someone was saying to me earlier, that we don't overlay our assumptions about the modern world onto the scriptures. Nevertheless, the landscape is still there. The environment is still there. And so we heard this story of Philip's journey down to Gaza. And I thought, not everyone's a map person, but I've just got some maps just so you get the idea of where we're talking about. So up here is Jerusalem. Some of you will have been to Jerusalem. And Philip is on his way down to Gaza, which is down here. And to get from Jerusalem to Gaza, you go through, it's desert. You'll see that there are tributary rivers that are going into the Mediterranean Sea, but it's basically desert. It is a treacherous road. And when we think about, you know, the story of the prodigal son, which is kind of everyone's favourite biblical story, not the prodigal son, the Good Samaritan, I apologise, the story of the Good Samaritan, and there's the road from Jerusalem to Jericho, and you might be aware that that is a treacherous road. That road is nothing compared with the road from Jerusalem to Gaza. It's a really difficult road, and it appears from the story that Philip is making the journey on foot. And he sort of sets out on this perilous journey because God tells him to, and he's heading down to Gaza. And when we talk about the Gaza Strip, sometimes we imagine that the Strip exists because there's a border around it. That's a very modern way of thinking. And to be fair, today there are huge fences and military installations around Gaza. But the reason, and it's right down here, it's not very big, right down here on the bottom, the reason it's the Gaza Strip is because it's hemmed in on either side. On one side is the ocean, and on the other side is desert. And the Strip is the strip of arable land, so there can be farms and, you know, olive groves and fruit and vegetables and so on, and animals can be farmed in that area. And that's why people settled there. To the south is the Sinai Desert. You can't really live there. That's where the Rafah crossing is now, where the Egyptian government is building camps for people who may escape from Gaza, which is slightly horrifying, and then the Negev Desert to the east, so you're hemmed in by desert on those sides. The reason there are today, the reason that there are 2 million people in Gaza, as some of you will know, because in 1948, in what the Israelis call the War of Independence and Palestinians call the Nakba, the catastrophe, people were displaced from all over what is now Israel and were resettled, forcibly resettled, displaced into Gaza. And through people having babies, as they tend to do, that population has grown significantly in that time. It's a very small space. So Philip's on his way to Gaza on the road, and he meets the Ethiopian eunuch. And, you know, I don't know about you, but nobody has ever said to me, you know, the Bible story that I love most of all is the story of the Ethiopian eunuch. That rarely comes up. And even when I was a kid, I had a big book of Bible stories, and that the story was in there, but I don't remember ever hearing a sermon or a Sunday school class about the story of the Ethiopian eunuch. Nevertheless, I think it's a really critical story, and it might be good for us to think about who this person is, who kind of comes into the story, gets baptized, and we never hear of him again. So it's described as a kind of court official of, in English, we say Candace, Queen of the Ethiopians. And that might sort of make us think, oh, a court official, or some guy who works for some woman called Candace. Kandake is a title, actually, not a name. And she was a queen, a very, very powerful, significant figure who ruled the kingdom of Kush, which is what we today would call Sudan and southern Sudan. Very, very powerful, very, very wealthy. And this person, who we call the Ethiopian eunuch, wasn't just the guy who brought her drinks or waved a fan behind her. He looked after the treasury. So this is a very, very senior bureaucrat. And, you know, the people who control the purse strings are usually very, very important in a kingdom like that. And he's also been trusted to go on this long journey from Sudan up to Jerusalem. So we get this, he's actually quite a senior character. He's travelled a very long way. And it says that he's gone up to worship in Jerusalem. It's also probable that he was undertaking a diplomatic mission. Perhaps he was going to buy materials or to borrow or lend money or something else was happening there. And so it's natural that while he's in Jerusalem, he may want to visit Herod's temple. And we get the sense from the text that he's what we sometimes in the scriptures is called a God-fearer. So someone who was not a Jew, but who wanted to understand the God of the Jewish experience, and sometimes those people converted to Judaism. But there are records, including in the New Testament, of people who would go to the local synagogue throughout the world, the known world at that time, who'd go to the synagogue and they would listen to the teaching, listen to the scriptures, but not actually convert. And our kind of catch-all name for those people is God-fearer. Whatever was going on for him in terms of his spiritual life, there he is on the road. He's in a chariot, which means he's got a horse, another sign of significant wealth. Philip is on foot, but the Holy Spirit says to Philip, hey, go talk to old mate in the chariot. And he does. I mean, you or I would do that too, wouldn't we? If God called us to bowl up to a rich stranger in a chariot, we would go and do that. And he's sitting in the chariot and he's reading from the book of Isaiah. And you know, like we might gloss over that and go, oh, well, he's probably just got his Gideon's Bible out of the motel and he's carrying it around with him. But, of course, that's not how the scriptures worked in that era. How on earth did a foreigner get their hands on either a full scroll? And it's possible that he's purchased a full scroll in Jerusalem or he's got some kind of excerpt. How on earth did he get his hands on the text of the book of the prophet Isaiah, and how was he carrying it and why did he have it? Because they had to be copied out by hand, right? Like this is a major, major artifact that he's holding in his hands, sitting in his chariot, and he's reading the book of Isaiah. And Philip, of course, goes up to him, and we'll talk in a moment about the text that he's reading. But Philip goes, and they talk, and he shares the good news about Jesus. And one of these tributary rivers, they're nearby, and the Ethiopian bureaucrat says, well, maybe I should be baptized, and Philip baptizes. Something that's really important, I think, about this text is where it's placed. I'll come back to those maps. Is where it's placed in the book of Acts. So the story that kind of the most common and popularly known story in Acts is in Acts 2, the day of Pentecost. I've got that little image there. They're not the best images. But you know the day of Pentecost, there were Jews from all over the known world. They're Jews of the dispersion. They're all gathered in Jerusalem, tongues of fire, understand people talking in their own languages. Oh, they are not drunk as you believe. It's only 9 o'clock in the morning. Well, I think people can be drunk at 9 o'clock in the morning, but that's what the Bible tells us. So that's the story of Pentecost in Acts 2, well known. And the narrative of Pentecost is a story about Jewish people in Jerusalem. And they are there for the Feast of Shavuot, so it's a story for the Jews. Now, the lesser known but still reasonably well-known story is called the Gentile Pentecost that happens in Acts chapter 10. And you might remember there's a centurion called Cornelius. Cornelius is sent by God to talk to Peter, the apostle Peter. And Peter at that time believed that the only way to follow Jesus was to be a Jew or become a Jew and follow the dietary laws and the keeping the Sabbath and all of that. But what we see happen in a vision is that Peter is shown clean and unclean animals, and he's told that there are no clean and unclean animals. Effectively, Gentiles can become Christian. And then we see that play out throughout the rest of the New Testament in the letters of Paul, who Paul's main thing is, hey, newsflash, Gentiles can become Christians, which is nice because I don't know if any of you are Jewish, but I'm glad that I'm not, so glad that I can be a Christian. And that was really the whole of the first century of Christianity, was coming to terms with the reality that it was not simply a movement inside Judaism, but a movement for the whole world. And so that vision of Peter is often called the Gentile Pentecost. That's the point at which it becomes clear that the Spirit is given not just to Jews, but to Gentiles as well. This story of the Ethiopian eunuch is just sort of nestled in a little crack in the middle of those two kind of high-profile stories. And I think it's weird that this story is just kind of popped in there. It's just kind of dropped in there in between these two iconic stories. And often the focus in the story is Philip's bilocation that happens, because if you read the text, Philip baptizes the eunuch, up he comes out of the water, and then Philip goes, and he disappears, and appears, we'll just go back to the map, he appears in Ashdod, which is up here. So he's on his way to Gaza, but he goes, pop, and then he relocates. And it's a miracle. And yeah, it is, but hang on, isn't the Ethiopian eunuch being baptized a miracle? Like, isn't that the remarkable part of the story? And of course, Philip then makes his way from Ashdod up to Caesarea, and that's where Peter and Cornelius are as well. So we get the sense that he's perhaps going up to that community up there. Now, to me, the story of the Ethiopian eunuch lives in a weird in-between place in the book of Acts. But the Ethiopian eunuch himself lives in a weird, weird in-between place. And forgive me, I'm going to just speak a little bit clinically or biologically, because we throw this word eunuch around, but it's probably helpful to understand what was actually going on. So this man, as a child, his testicles were surgically removed or crushed. It would have been immensely painful, and that would have had an impact then on his hormones as he grew up. And so as an adult, his voice and physical appearance would have been different to other people, and so he was absolutely identified as separate to other people, had a separate identity. Now, some of you will know about islander cultures, friends, for example, that have a third gender, fafafine in some places. And actually throughout human history, there's often been, in our cultures, we've had another place for people who are gender non-conforming, which is, it's been a normal part of human history. And today in sort of Western culture, we're starting to be more understanding that this is normal part of our community. So people who are non-binary, people who are intersex, or people who are transitioning or affirming gender, we're starting to understand very, very slowly as a community how kind of normal this is. But it's also, I think, really important to remember that we have this non-binary, gender non-conforming character in the scriptures, perhaps not by his choice, but that was who he was. Because this person is a eunuch, we can say with high confidence that he was also a slave. Because he was a eunuch, he was not permitted or able to enter into a relationship, and he was not biologically able to have children, which is further marginalising. And yet, this character has risen through the ranks in the royal court. He's risen in the public service and got to the highest levels. And even though when he got to Jerusalem, to the temple, he wouldn't have been allowed in, because the book of Deuteronomy says that eunuchs are not to be admitted to the assembly of the Lord. So here's this person who occupies this marginal space in his own community, who, even as he's out on the road, even as he's travelling, was immediately identifiable as out of the ordinary, on the edges. And yet this is the person who Philip is called to bowl up to, talk about Jesus and who baptizes. And this happens to this Gentile. This Gentile is baptized before the Gentile Pentecost. He's like the beginning of that Gentile baptism movement. Jews have been baptized, but not Gentiles until after this. Often, I said, hope emerges out of the cracks. And I think, too, we find God in those in-between spaces, just like this Ethiopian eunuch in the story found God in the in-between places. And it reminds me that just as we have light and dark, we also have twilight and dusk. And I don't know about you, but I often sense the presence of God more closely at twilight and dusk. We have land and we have sea, but we also have that bit that's where the tides come and go, that's sort of land and sea. And I don't know about you, but as I stood on Bathers Beach yesterday, the presence of God in that community on the beach was perhaps, for me, a bit more real, a bit more immediate. And so these in-between spaces, too, are part of the created order, are part of nature, and part of human history. And as I worked alongside Palestinian Christians, I was really, really moved by their sense of being in the in-between space. They're Australians, but they're Palestinians. They're Arabs, but they're Christians. They're Christians, but they're not like the most, you know, the most generic Christians that we're used to in the West. Even the Eastern Catholics, they're Catholics, but they're Eastern. All of these in-between spaces and kind of caught with these multiple identities. The text that the eunuch is reading is from Isaiah. Like a sheep, he was led to the slaughter, and like a lamb silent before its shearer, so he does not open his mouth. In his humiliation, justice was denied him. Who can describe his generation? For his life is taken away from the earth. Perhaps we can understand why this text was so difficult for him to understand or to engage with, and why he invites a stranger to sit with him and talk about it. Who is this person? And when Philip says, oh, let me tell you about Jesus, can you imagine how this person who lives in the in-between spaces would have been drawn to the character of Jesus, to the sacrifice of Jesus, to the senseless murder of Jesus? And why he immediately says, well, this is what I want. This is who I want to be. He recognizes perhaps in Jesus a fellow traveler and says, well, this is the life for me. It's a weird story. It's a weird story about a person who lived in a weird space in the community. And I think that's just the most amazing good news. And I'd invite you to think about where your cracks are, where the margins are, where the in-between spaces are, where you can go looking for hope and go looking for God. Because I actually suspect that if we go looking for hope in the good places, the happy places, the positive things, we might find God. But if we go looking for God in the cracks where the tiniest little seed, you know, spits up and spits out a flower, if we go looking for God in the midst of darkness where the tiniest glimmer of light can be glimpsed, we will absolutely find the presence of God there. And God of hope will fill our hearts in those places. Amen.
Chris, as I read the Bible reading, you know, this is a comment about where this story shows up from what you said. What I noticed, curiously, is this story occurs just before the conversion of Saul to Paul's story.
Yeah, so the eunuch comes to Christ before the Apostle Paul, the greatest evangelist and apostle. Yeah, we don't. I must say, at the Melkite Church, they have an icon to the Ethiopian eunuch. I've never seen any attribute. They may exist, but I've never seen attribution to the Ethiopian eunuch in Western churches. Yeah.
First, my takeaway from the story has always been that Philip was somebody who was totally tuned into God, and he spoke with whoever he was directed to speak to. So, I must say, it's never occurred to me that the eunuch was particularly. Because they were in society, as part of that society. So, yes, as a person who understood that the guidance of Jesus or God speaking to him, he just went and did what he was told to do.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting if we start to see that story through the lens of the other marginalized people that we meet in the Gospels, for instance. So the woman caught in adultery, the Syrophoenician woman, when Jesus passes through Samaria. We see in the Gospels that Jesus engages with groups that were considered, people of groups that were considered unclean or separate. And then we see that continue in Acts and then kind of meet its, you know, come to life in the work of Paul as he takes the good news to the whole world. Yeah.
I just have a question, because I'm assuming that he's quite an important man and he's probably carrying money. Would he really have been travelling by himself?
Ah, very interesting. Yeah, and this is one of those things where the text is silent. But, yeah, good point, probably not. And isn't that fascinating to think about, that maybe he had 30 retainers with their own chariots and horses and still Philip has to ball up to him. Yeah.
And what he does is public. Mm. Not, he's not... He's seen to do what he does. So.
Yeah. Interesting.
Following on from that thought, this guy's a diplomat. He's a representative of his government. He's dealing with other nations. You think about who Jesus is, Jesus' story, what this guy has just been told about Jesus. There's no separating that from the political realities. He's choosing to take that on board and take that home with him as a senior government official. That's quite a radical step to take.
Absolutely. And while the historicity of some of the narratives might be worth questioning, in the Ethiopian Orthodox Church, they say that he took Christianity to Ethiopia. And they would say that that's where Christianity really began, was Ethiopia. I'm like, oh, okay, I'll take that on board. But the other thing is that there are now and have been Jews in Ethiopia for many, like for millennia. And indeed, if you go to Ethiopia, the Jewish community there will tell you that they are custodians of the real Ark of the Covenant. So take that with however you like. But it's fascinating. You're right, the sort of geopolitics of both Judaism and Christianity travelling into Africa, yeah, there's a whole other window that might open up for us.
Hi, a couple of little pedantic points. Sorry. Surprise. One is that the story is not silent about whether he's alone, because he gives the order for the chariot to continue. So he's
well
obviously
spotted.
Not himself driving the chariot. So, yes, you're right, he's with an entourage of some, at least a driver. Yeah, and the second one is that your comment about as a eunuch, he nonetheless arose to positions of power. But I think the creation of eunuchs was actually designed to supply the need for high officials who could be trusted because they weren't distracted by sex.
Yes, that's true. And thank you, I did kind of gloss over that. And we believe that in the royal court, it was very common for bureaucrats or officials to be eunuchs, and that very often they sort of lived together lived and worked together as well. But yeah, thank you for adding to that.
So my question is, if he's gone up to Jerusalem to learn, and for some specific work, but he was actually reading Isaiah. If he couldn't go into the temple, where would he learn and get that sort of access?
Sure, and thank you again, because the temple was a sort of a precinct, so he certainly couldn't go into the inner areas, but there were kind of the porticos where he could have gone if he wanted to and listened to. And remember, Jesus set up in those porticos and did teaching, and so lots of travelling rabbis and teachers would do that.
One tiny thing which I thought I was going to come out with first. I identify with the eunuch in that I'm weird too, and I just recognise how for a long time I've been going, yeah, I really relate with this Jesus character. I'm hoping I'm not going to get nailed on a cross, but...
Thank you, yeah.
Just a comment about the Palestinian Christians. I really understand what you're saying about the ones here in Australia feeling in a in-between place. The ones in Israel do too, because the majority of Palestinians are Muslim and they look down on the Christians, And, of course, the other big population are the Jews, which look down on all Palestinians. So the Palestinians have been leaving Israel in fairly large numbers because they're persecuted from both directions. And, of course, then they end up in another country where they're still in between people.
And there's an interesting new little wrinkle to that story. Just in the last 20 years, there's a growing group of Christians inside the state of Israel who are Filipino. And the reason Filipinos are going to Israel is to work as domestic workers and manual labourers. They can make money and send it back to their families in the Philippines. And because they've now been there for a couple of decades, they've had children and are forming large communities. And the children go to school and they learn in Hebrew. So they look Filipino, but they speak Hebrew. And their parents are having to learn Hebrew in order to help their children with their schoolwork. And so in the Western Catholic Church in Tel Aviv, that is a church that has been set up by the Catholic Church predominantly to serve the Filipino worker community. And you know how in Australia we have English as a second language classes? The Catholic Church in Tel Aviv has Hebrew as a second language classes for the Filipino workers. And so there's this, and oh, the other amazing thing is, for the first time in human history, the Mass, the Catholic Mass, has been had to be translated into Hebrew so that the children could hear Mass in their own language, which is, since Vatican II, is required in the Catholic Church. There are many, many more wrinkles like that in both Palestinian and Israeli society where the kind of combination of cultures there. The other fascinating group of Christians in the state of Israel are Russians, who are Russian Orthodox, who are absolutely Russian Orthodox, but if they have an ancestor who was Jewish, a lot of them have been able to qualify for Jewish citizenship, and Israel is often a better place to live than Russia. So there are about 100,000 Russian Orthodox Jews who are Christians who worship in the Russian Orthodox Church, which is why there are now more Christians in Israel than there are Christians in Palestine for the first time since the establishment of the state. Anyway, thank you so much.
One more question on that? What about Jewish Christians? Are they Christians?
So you might mean Messianic Jews is sometimes what they're called. Yeah, that's a whole other world, and maybe we'll talk over morning tea about that because it's very complicated.